Okay, how do I sound? Okay, I'm Jamie, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jamie.
And my sobriety birthday is July 5th, 2004, so I have 12 years.
Yay!
My home group is Here and Now. We meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays. We study the 12 and 12 and the Big Book. And also one of my core groups that I get really squirrely if I miss it is the, as Bill sees it, spiritual breakfast on Sunday mornings. And it's a great breakfast for $3. Breakfast is at 9 at the Campfire Clubhouse in Port Angeles. And then our meeting's from 9:30 to 11. And we read from the As Bill Sees It book. Thank you, Neil and Sally and Kathy and everyone for being here and showing support. And I'm going to refer to the Big Book a lot. I just, you know, the Big Book, like it talks about in the doctor's opinion, I'm sold on the ideas contained in this book because, you know, my life was such a mess and I just wanted to die. And the things, the ideas and principles in this book really turned my life around. And I just hope that something I say will move you and that you can maybe relate to my story, that you can, if you're feeling hopeless, that, you know, it will bring you hope. And a lot of you have a lot more time than me, but maybe it will remind you about something and we can all grow together. I want to start out by saying, you know, as far as my life goes, I like that part in the doctor's opinion that talks about, to them, their alcoholic life seems like the only normal one. Because, you know, my life, to me, I thought it was perfectly normal. And I did have a really good childhood. Like, my parents, they did a lot of really fun things. We went fishing and camping and played games, and we always had a huge garden. And, you know, I learned how to, like, can and sew and do things, you know. And my parents did a lot of really neat things with us, and we always lived in a really good neighborhood. And, you know, so I did have a lot of really good things in my childhood. And I'm using notes because my sponsor warned me that I have to end on time, and that's the only way I can do it, because I'll, like, just talk all night. So I am going to look at my notes. And, you know, I had what I like to call a balanced spiritual upbringing. My mom would take me to the Baptist church, and I'd have this hellfire and brimstone, you know, stuff, and learn about all these miracles. And then I'd go home, and my dad, who's a scientist, would tell me why that was impossible to be true. And so, you know, I got a good balance there. But, you know, on page 64 in the Big Book, it talks about our liquor was but a symptom. And, you know, even from, like, a really young age, I always kind of had this underlying sense that I just was not good enough. And there was this, you know, there were, like, family fights and rebellion, you know, that type of thing. And I remember, like, when I was really young, like 7 or 8, and a lot of you might remember the show, like, Adam 12 and Dragnet, you know those shows? And they would show people on pot like zombies. You know, and I remember seeing that thinking, I want to be like that. You know, like at 7 or 8 years old, I wanted to be like that. That was my goal. And so, like, I was on this quest to attain that zombie-like state, you know, pretty young. And I remember my older sister and I, we would try things, like, we heard that you could get high on banana peels, and you're supposed to bake them. I think you're supposed to smoke them, but we ate them, and ew, we didn't get high. And, you know, we would get into the liquor cabinet, and, you know, I had a few times where, you know, me and my friend snuck into the liquor cabinet. And, you know, I was just always one of these people, I didn't realize it at the time, but I have, like, a really high tolerance for alcohol or drugs, you know, so it took me a lot And my friends would be acting all silly, and I just thought they were faking it, because I was drinking like they were drinking, and I was young, but nothing was happening. So, you know, the taste wasn't really worth it, because I wasn't really getting anything from it. And so, you know, I just kept on this quest, you know, looking for something and trying whatever I could find. But, you know, we lived in good neighborhoods, so we didn't really have drug dealers around. So, you know, we started, you know, my sister and I, she was on this quest too. We started like going to the other side of town and, you know, and so then I got into pot, and after I tried that a number of times, I finally, you know, got high. And I'm like, this is what it's about. But, you know, my motto for a long time was never pass up the opportunity to get high or to get higher. And so that's what I did. But after a while, I got something that was bad, and I OD'd on it. And so, you know, then every time I did anything, I would have like these flashbacks of this overdose. And so at that time, you know, my family, I thought my family was super cool. We all partied, you know, we just were a bunch of, they were drinkers and partiers, and I just thought they were so much fun, and their friends were all partiers. And so, you know, I decided, well, maybe I'd try just straight hard alcohol. And that was the ticket for me, you know, just having the straight alcohol, that would do the trick. And so I just went straight from the, you know, I didn't want to take the risk with the drugs. I just went straight to the alcohol, and that was exactly what I loved, you know, and that gave me that feeling that I was looking for. And so anyway, you know, everyone I knew drank or drugged, and that was normal. You know, I mean, it was like, I didn't have to hide it. We all partied together, and I thought that was great. And, but, you know, I kind of sensed that there was a problem with other people that I hung around with. You know, I could see some of them might have a problem, you know, but I didn't think I thought I was had it all under control. And so, you know, when I was in high school, you know, I partied with everyone, and my high school sweetheart and I, you know, we were talking about marriage, and we always said, you know, if we ever have kids, we really cannot party like this, because it was pretty hardcore. It's hard to raise kids when you're like out all night and hungover the whole next day, you know. And so, you know, we're like, yeah, we were in agreement about that. And so, you know, partying along, and at the age of 19, I get pregnant. And so, you know, time to settle down. You know, I'm gonna have kids now, so we gotta quit partying. And so I quit drinking, and I didn't realize it, but I went through major withdrawal. But I didn't know that's what it was. I had no idea that's what it was. I just thought I was going crazy. And everyone around me thought so too, because no one else that I knew was trying to quit drinking or anything. And so nobody knew to tell me, you're just going through withdrawal. You know, we just all thought I was crazy. And so, you know, because even after that first initial physical withdrawal, there's a big emotional withdrawal that happens with alcohol. And for me, it was really hard on me, and not just me, everyone in my family, you know, suffered the consequences of my emotional withdrawal. It reminds me, in the 12 and 12, it talks about the emotional hangover. The direct result of yesterday's and sometimes today's excesses of negative emotion, anger, fear, jealousy, and the like. That was me, full of all of that. Just total negative. And, you know, I didn't really realize it until I didn't have alcohol to just kind of blow it all off or, you know, take care of that. I had just really disabling anxiety. Like, I mean, I would just be on the ground, disabled by the anxiety. And so what I finally found that kind of relieved it was God. And so it's like, well, if a little's good, a lot's better. And so I got really obsessive about God, so much to the point that people were just like, oh God, here she comes, she's gonna, you know, thump, thump. And, you know, it was, you know, I don't know how, I lost a lot of friends during that period of my life. And, but anyway, you know, because I did not realize that I was an alcoholic and I didn't realize what the problem was, eventually, by the time I was 24, I did drink again. And, you know, it just started out like one beer. And, of course, you know the story. I mean, you know, I just can't stop at one. And really, what is the point of one beer? You know, I mean, to me, I never really understood why a person would want to drink if it wasn't just to get really drunk, you know. So, you know, I was drinking again, and by this time I had 3 kids, and I was married, but I was really unhappy. And I just remember being, like, mad all the time, thinking, are we having fun yet? And, you know, I just, like, my obsession had just really gone rampant because, you know, like I say, alcohol is just a symptom of my problem. I'm just so obsessive and controlling, and the more I would try to control things, the worse it got, you know, the more out of control it would get. And so I'd try different things, and, you know, I'd try to control the kids and the husband, and I'd take all these classes, and I'd go to counseling, and I'd have them go to counseling, and I'd go to family counseling, and I took so many classes trying to figure out how to control my kids, I ended up with a degree in early childhood education. And true story, and you know, I just couldn't figure out how to get these people under control, you know, and I just knew that, you know, that I could do it, you know, but it's kind of like on page 60, 61, I was like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in my own way. If my arrangements would only stay put. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So anyway, they wouldn't stay put. So I blamed my dad. And, you know, I just thought it's because, you know, I never learned from him. You know, he was just such an asshole growing up. Sorry, Dad. But then something happened. He got sober in this program, and he got really nice. I mean, he just got really cool. I mean, just, and I was still unhappy. And I'm like, oh, wow, you know, it wasn't him, you know. So it must be my drug addict husband. Yeah, it wasn't my dad, it must be my drug addict husband. So I started putting pressure on him about his drugs. And then something happened. My drinking buddy's sister, she got sober. And she told me some amazing things that were just mind-blowing. She told me that there are people who actually don't even think about drinking, not at all. And I'm like, what kind of wuss are you hanging out with, you know, really? She's like, no, there are people and they are normal, they're not wusses, that don't even think about drinking. And they don't think, if they don't drink, they don't even think like how long they've gone without a drink. Like it doesn't even occur to them, oh, I've gone like a whole month without a drink. That doesn't even like occur to them. And she said, only alcoholics keep track of how long they're going without a drink. If you're normal, it doesn't even cross your mind. And this is how she knew that she was an alcoholic. And I'm just like, I just think you're hanging around weirdos, you know, they just don't know how to drink is their problem, you know. But I was glad that she figured out she was an alcoholic, because she really was, you know. And so, and also my dad too, you know, I mean, they just really, it just changed their life, you know. And I mean, I drank with them, I knew how crazy they were, and so, you know, I was really glad they got help. Now, if only my husband could realize he had a problem. And so, you know, I start putting on the pressure, you know, and And after a while, when I was about 30, he called me on my stuff. He said, look at the pot calling the kettle black. You are an alcoholic. And I just thought, well, I'll show him. I am not an alcoholic. I will not drink, and I will not even think about drinking because I'm not an alcoholic, and I won't even think like how long it's been since I've had a drink because I'm not an alcoholic. And so this was my goal. And so about a few days went by, and there was a friend who was having a birthday. And so of course, you know, you gotta get drunk for that. And afterwards I'm like, oh, I was not gonna drink, and it wasn't even gonna bother me. And I'm like, oh, okay, so I'm gonna start over. That was just like, you know, a test, or, you know, I had to drink because it was their birthday, you know. So a few days go by, and I'm thinking about like how long it's been since I've had a drink. And I'm like, wait, no, I can't think about that because, you know, well, anyway, if, you know, I kept having these occasions to drink and thinking about it. And I'm like, oh my gosh, I think I'm an alcoholic. And so I call up my mom, who is the first person who got into recovery in our family in Al-Anon. And I would find like these little recovery things around the house. And anyway, and they were pretty interesting. I really liked the stories in the back of the book of the Big Book, because these people like partied like me, you know. But anyway, so I told my mom, you know, I think I'm an alcoholic, and she said, what a surprise. And so she took me to my first AA meeting in 1992. And, you know, the same thing started happening. I started going through that withdrawal. And I called my sister up, and I said, I think something is just like seriously wrong. I feel like so stressed out. I feel like I put the baby on top of the car and drove off or something. I mean, that's how anxious I felt. And she's like, no. She goes, I said, I just feel like I'm forgetting something. She said, you are forgetting something. Your body is forgetting to drink, and your body wants to drink, and you are going through withdrawal. And she said, get a sponsor, work the steps, and it will get better. And I'm like, oh, okay. So I knew I wasn't gonna die. I was just withdrawal, and it was such a relief. And then I talked about it at AA, and people talked about how what happened to them when they had withdrawal and how they got through it and the different things. And so, you know, that really helped me a lot to actually know, oh, this is why I'm feeling this way. It's withdrawal. And actually doing the steps did start making it get better. And I got this sponsor, her name was Phoenix, and a lot of you might remember her. She's not around anymore. I just loved her. And she had me reading that part that I just read about the actors trying to arrange the show. And she, you know, we did the steps 1 and 2, and then we got to 3, and she was having me read that. And then I was supposed to call her. And so I read it, and I called her, and she's like, so what'd you think? And I'm like, well, I don't see what that has to do with me. Yeah. She's like, okay, well, just read it again and call me tomorrow. And I swear, like, how could she not just slap me? You know, it's like so obvious what my problem was. But she just kept telling me, just read it again and call me tomorrow. And I don't know how long it took me, at least a couple weeks, maybe more. And one night I called her up, and I'm like, I kind of relate to this actor, you know, trying to arrange the show type of thing. And she's like, now we're getting somewhere, you know. And so we moved on, but she would say things like to me like, go to Al-Anon. And so I tried that, and that just really pissed me off because, you know, I'm not going to give up on controlling these things. You know, I'm not going to take this stuff lying down. I'm going to get these people in my life sober, you know. And so I really, you know, didn't have, well, you know, I'm powerless over alcohol, but I'm not powerless over their alcohol or drugs, you know. So that's what I thought. And so Al-Anon just irritated me. And she would make me read things like the acceptance thing, and, you know, and so, you know, I just really didn't get that part. But I did the best I could, and I did actually start feeling better the anxiety and the anger started to subside. But, you know, I just really couldn't let go, I mean, of the fact that I was powerless over alcohol, not just mine, you know. And because of that, my life got really unmanageable, and my poor kids and, you know, the man I was married to, their life got unmanageable, because if mama ain't happy, ain't no one happy. And, you know, I was going to get everyone lined up. And so, you know, in 1999, with 7 years of sobriety, I decided that I was going to stay spiritually fit on my own. So I tell my sponsor, and you know what she said, let me know how that works out for you. And so, you know, I take off, and I'm, you know, going to church and doing all these things, and I'm taking all these classes and going to counseling, having the kids in counseling. I'm going to Bible studies. I volunteered in the classroom, and, you know, I volunteered and was like team mom and all this stuff, because I'm going to do these things to prevent my kids from ever getting into drugs and alcohol. Because if I do all this stuff, you know, it will keep them, you know, they'll have a happy life. And in spite of doing all that stuff, all of my kids got into drugs and alcohol. I couldn't believe it. It's like, what is up with this, God? I'm doing everything, you know, right? So why, you know, why is this happening? And on top of that, you know, the husband was still using. And so, you know, I just stepped up my controlling and stuff. And finally, in, let's see, well, when I got 10 years of sobriety in 2002, everything was really a mess in my life. I was going through the motions, working and going to school, you know, to get my early childhood education degree, and doing all these things. But, you know, my family life was just falling apart. I never saw my kids, and I would, you know, sometimes lay awake at night just praying for my kids, wondering if they were alive, you know. And my daughter got involved with this guy who was a lot older than her, pedophile, and he was very manipulative, and he got her pregnant. And so I went to the police, but she was 16, and when you're 16, that's not illegal to get pregnant. It doesn't matter how old the person is. And that just about drove me crazy. And then on top of that, my mom, she had emphysema, and she was in and out of the hospital, and a lot of times we didn't know, is she going to make it? She was on life support a number of times. And so, you know, I just felt like I was totally justified to be mad at God because of all this stuff, and I indulged in that, and I just became full of anger. And that anger took over my life. And that anger, you know, even when I wasn't really angry, there was always like this underlying anger. And it got to the point where, like, I would wake up in the morning and I would just want the day to be over, because I just had nothing to look forward to. And I just worried all the time. I was always fearful about everything. And so, but I kept kind of going through the motions, and my husband and I bought this house. It was like our dream house. And the day that we closed on the house and we went in, he was having a drink. And he looked at me, and I don't know why, because I hadn't had a drink in 10 years, but he said, "You want a drink?" And I'm like, "Yeah." And I said, "But don't put any mixer or ice in there. Just put the whiskey in the glass, you know?" So, you know, I had a drink, and then I had another drink. I only had two drinks, and I didn't even get drunk. And so the next day, I was thinking about it. I'm like, wow, I only had two drinks, tall glasses of whiskey, but, you know, I only had two drinks, and I didn't get drunk, and I must not be an alcoholic, so I can drink every day. I was so excited about that. It kind of, last night, my home group, we were reading the big book, and we were reading about the jaywalker. Mm-hmm. And that story reminds me about that, you know, how I just think or the guy right before that, there's a story about this guy who thinks if he puts the whiskey in his milk, he's not going to get drunk. And it seems so ludicrous. And, you know, I remember reading those stories thinking, how ridiculous. But then I go and have two glasses of whiskey and think that I'm not an alcoholic and that I can drink every day. Well, you know, what kind of person is so excited that they can drink every day now? And then I did. I drank every day for like 2 years, every single day. And I had never drank every day before I had quit. I had, I would like save it up for the weekends. I'd maybe have a beer or something to kind of take the edge off, but then I'd party on the weekends. But I had never drank every single day. And when I picked up again in 2002, I drank every day. And and I remember, you know, towards the end of that time period, I was trying to figure out, I was drinking like earlier and earlier in the evening, and I was trying to figure out how I could maybe get away with doing it at work, which is really bad because I worked in social services, and I would put on these things like for parent education, how to get sober, and you know, things like that we were mandated to do trainings on, and here I was, like my life was just falling apart. So anyway, I just kept going along really unhappy, you know, waking up wanting to be dead, and I would just like fantasize about it. And for the longest time, see, I wouldn't talk about it because if you knew what I was thinking, I would probably get put in an insane asylum and lose my job. You know, I wasn't thinking about like the fact that I was really seriously thinking about killing myself, and I would probably lose my job if I did that. But you know, you know, I just didn't. You know, at that point, you know, nothing really made sense. It seemed normal. It seemed like it's sensible thinking. But my thinking was, you know, that if I kill myself, I don't want anyone to try to talk me out of it. So I'm not going to talk about it, and I don't want anyone to know what I'm thinking, because when I do it, I'm going to do it. And I came up with this plan to do it. I was going to shoot myself in the head, and I had it all figured out, this elaborate plan that I was going to, you know, call 911, shoot myself, and then they would come clean me up before anyone came home and found this mess, you know. And so I went to get the gun. And someone had stolen our gun. I was so mad, you know, that all these people hanging out at our house, these drug addicts and just lowlifes, someone had stolen the gun. And once again, you know, my plans are ruined because someone... And so that, you know, when I got back in the rooms, that whole thing really helped me with that part in the chapter on acceptance, the part nothing, absolutely nothing happens in God's world by mistake. And what I thought was the worst thing that could happen to a nice girl like me turned out to be the best thing. And it really did. It saved my life. You know, all this stuff was going on, and in spite of that, there was this higher power that intervened to save my life. And I was just, you know, my mom was really sick at the time, like I said, and I have to kind of talk about this because it's kind of tied in with what I think was really a spiritual experience in my life and turned me around. My mom was on life support. She'd gotten MRSA in her lungs, and she was just like, she was not going to make it. We had to call my sister who lived in Michigan, and my aunt and uncle from Oklahoma, and I was, you know, hoping that I could just stay sober enough to like go sit with my mom and be there with her, and you know, then I'd drink and hope that, you know, I wouldn't get the call that I'd have to go there again. But anyway, I remember just like sitting there by my mom, and you know, we knew she was gonna die. The doctor said, you know, and we were just waiting for my sister and aunt and uncle, and we were gonna take her off life support. And I was sitting there, and I was praying, God, please don't let her die. Please don't let her die. God, please don't let her die. And I was just like praying like crazy. And all of a sudden, it was like this God smack. And I realized, you know, her disease was progressing. And if she did not die, she would be suffering so tremendously. And it was just like all of a sudden, I just thought, thy will be done. And I really accepted that. That was like the first time, I think, in my whole life that I really thought, God, thy will be done. And I really thought, you know, if she dies, I can accept this. This really would be, you know, I would accept it. And in that moment, it was like all of a sudden I realized, what if everything I'm praying about is wrong? Because here I thought, you know, I'm praying, don't let her die. And what if what I'm praying about is wrong? What if everything I believe about God and prayer is wrong? What if everything I believe about how I'm supposed to raise my kids, how I'm supposed to do this, what if it's wrong? It was just like this moment, like this, I don't know how to explain it, just such a moment of clarity that I just knew right then and there that I had to either change everything about my life or I was going to die. And I knew I had to come back to AA. And so I did. I came back to AA, and I got to catch up on my notes where I'm at here. So just a second. So I remember, like, certain things just started really popping out at me. It's things I'd heard before, but I had never heard before. Like, I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems. And that's, you know, from the Big Book. And then I went to a roundup, and I can't remember who it was, if it was Clancy or Sandy Beach, or somebody had this set-aside prayer that goes, God, please set aside everything that I think I know about myself, my brokenness, my spiritual path in you, for an open mind and a new experience of myself, my brokenness, my spiritual path, and especially you. And that just was like, yes, that is exactly what I need to do. And I remember just thinking, feeling so like I had no goals or anything, like I had no beliefs, because I just felt like everything I believe is wrong because my life is such a mess. I thought, you know, if I did all this stuff, it would turn out this certain way, and it wasn't like that. So I just really started questioning everything I thought. And I would go to meetings, and, you know, immediately people are talking about God, who I was pissed at, and I would want to not listen. And then I think, no, I gotta listen, because everything I think about God is wrong. And so I need to listen and hear what they're telling me about God. And then I'd hear someone say something that was just like, that is so wrong. And then I'm like, no, I gotta listen to that, because everything I think is wrong. I mean, I know that I ended up just wanting to die. And so there must be something wrong with my thinking. It's not what everyone else is thinking. These people, it's the same people that I saw before, and they are happy. And that is what I wanted more than anything. More than I'd gotten the house I thought I wanted. I'd gotten the job I thought I wanted. I'd gotten education. I'd gotten the van that I thought. I had all these things I thought I wanted, and I was not happy. I was so miserable. I was like, I just, you know, didn't want to live. And all I wanted at that point was just to want to have hope. So I came in here hoping to have hope. And I listened to you like I never listened ever before. And when I would start doubting what you were saying, I'd tell myself to knock it off, because everything I was thinking was wrong. And I also quit praying the way that I'd been praying. I'd always thought it was really phony to pray these pre-written prayers. And so I would only pray what I thought, you know. I would only pray that my own prayers, my original thoughts. And then I heard this quote by Einstein: the consciousness that created the problem cannot be the same consciousness that solves the problem. That was my problem. I'm sitting here trying to use the same way I'm thinking to solve my problem. And so I became willing to, I just threw out any of my own prayers. I only, for like the first couple years, the only prayers I would do were straight from the Big Book, and the Big Book is full of prayers. It is awesome. Or if my sponsor recommended certain prayers, then I would use those from AA literature or different spiritual, you know, it does tell us be quick to see where religious people are right. And there are a lot of really good prayers. My sponsor now, she says, you become what you meditate on. And I really believe that, you know, it just gradually has changed my mind and my way of thinking. So it is really, you know, that has been a huge part of my recovery. But I want to go back to the story about my mom, because I do want to say that the unexpected did happen with my mom when we were going to take her off life support, and we did, and she didn't die, and she got a lung transplant, and she's here tonight. And you know, that was just like a huge miracle. But then a few years after I'd been sober, my mom spoke at out at Camp David Jr., and I listened to her. And then I heard the other side of the story of the woman in the bed. Because you've heard my story. I was sitting there praying, God, don't let her die. And then I had this God smack. Well, I heard her talking about that night that she was in the bed. And she knew she was dying, but she was on life support. She was kind of, you know, in and out of it. She couldn't talk because all these tubes were in her mouth. But she knew she was maybe going to die because she could tell, like, my sister was there, my aunt and uncle were there, I was there. And she knew everyone in her family was really upset. And she was thinking, you know, she felt ready to die. She feels at peace about that with her creator. But what she really hated was that, you know, we were suffering so much. And she thought, I wish there was something I could do to help. And what she did is she thought, I can do something to help. I can pray for her. And I think that when she did that is when I got that smack. I just am convinced that was that whole thing working out. You know, when she told that story, I started bawling in this thing. You know? I mean, nobody knew what was going on, but like I knew what was going on. And that was like such a miracle to me when I heard her say that story, and it really just reinforced the power of prayer. And the thing is that I do realize that, you know, like I used to try to pray it into happening, and I do realize that is playing God when I do that. But prayer really is powerful, and especially when we pray, you know, unselfishly. And so anyway, I did get back into recovery, and so since then I've actually had six sponsors, and I haven't fired them, and they have not fired me. But I've just moved around. I think that was another thing where my higher power knew that I just am sicker than others and needed a lot of help. Because when I came in this room, like I wanted to quit drinking, but I couldn't quit drinking. I would come to the meeting and I would go home and I'd drink, you know, and I think, oh, you know, I'm gonna start over again tomorrow. And so I'd, you know, stay sober for the day, and then I'd go to a meeting and I'd go home and I'd drink. And I just, you know, kept doing that. And then one day I was thinking, God, why am I not able to quit drinking? I just, you know, I don't want to drink anymore. And then that section in the How It Works popped into my head. Some are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. And I thought, oh no, I'm one of those. I was born that way, and I'm doomed. Oh no. And in that moment, it was like the first honest thing I'd said to myself. You know, that whole thing about, I was just talking about this the other day, denial. Don't even notice I am lying. And it was like, you know, I noticed, yeah, that's the thing, is that I am constitutionally incapable of being honest with myself. And at that point, I became willing to look at myself no matter how ugly I thought I might look. Because I always felt like if I'm going to go to this creator or God or whatever it is, that I really need to present this clean thing, not this junk that I am, not this mess that I am. I really need to, like, you know, have something good to offer. And I really became willing at that point to just give it all over to this creator, however I am. And it helped me to have the courage to really look at the things that I don't like about myself. And it took me a while. I did, after about 6 months, finally I was able to go home and not take a drink. I just was so obsessed that I had to drink on the 4th of July, so that's why my sobriety date's the July 5th, because I could not let go of that. I got to get drunk on the 4th of July, you know, but so, you know, the 5th of July, and what was really a bummer about that is I didn't even get drunk. I drank and drank and drank, and I couldn't get drunk, and it was like, oh, okay, I'm done. And so, but I still wanted to drink for, like, years, and so I know a lot of people, they just have that removed, but I just want to encourage you that if you know, are still struggling with that, just don't give up. And even, you know, even after having some years, there's been times that have triggered that thought, but I don't have to drink. Even if I think about it and want it, I don't have to do it. And that is just a miracle. But I remember, you know, after I'd gone through the steps and, you know, first I had this one sponsor and she took me through the steps, and you know, I realized after the first year, this marriage is really, you know, not working out. We'd been together all this time, and you know, he wanted to use and I wanted to be sober, and we were having yet again the other fight, and we'd been married 24 years, and he said, well, you can't expect someone to change overnight. And I'm like, you know, I can't expect someone to change, period. You know, it was like, what am I doing? Why do I expect him to change? You know, why do I expect anyone to change? And so we did get a divorce, and immediately, you know, I waited 4 whole months and got remarried. And that's when my sponsor said, you need professional help. And I'm like, geez, what do you mean I need professional help? You know, and I really did need professional help. But that was one of those things. I still was thinking about dying, that I wanted to kill myself. I still hadn't told anyone. That was the one thing in my, you know, my fourth step I wouldn't admit to anyone. And so when I got remarried, we moved up to Alaska, and I got this sponsor up there, and she got me through all the steps. And you know, I was feeling better, but I still kept thinking about this, wanting to die. And every once in a while, you know, I'd want a drink. And finally, I said to her, you know, I got to tell someone this, that, you know, there's days that I wake up and I don't want to wake up, and I cannot start my day over. You know how they tell you start your day over? I'm like, I just cannot start my day over. And she showed me the part in the big book, I don't know, I'm really lost on my notes here. But anyway, it talks about how we can't, we should always, something about, you know, good psychiatrists are, there's nothing wrong with seeing a good psychiatrist or doctor. And so it might be written in my big book, because, use doctor psychiatrist, page 133. Let me see, my big book's kind of falling apart here. This book has saved my life, and I've worn it out. So try to remember that though God has wrought miracles among us, we should never belittle a good doctor or psychiatrist. I gotta get a drink of water. Just. And so when it was put to me that way, instead of you need professional help, which I did, but you know, when it's told to you like that, it's kind of like, I don't need help, you know. You're the one who needs help. But when my sponsor in Alaska put it to me like that, then I became willing, and I was, you know, when the pain gets great enough, you'll do something about it. So I did go to a psychiatrist, and, you know, they helped me a lot. And it was really kind of cool, because the person I saw, the things that she was having me do, really dealt with me looking at my own distorted thinking, kind of like how we do in the in the steps. You know, we look at our distorted thinking, our distorted behavior, and we look at how we can do it differently. And so that went really hand in hand with my recovery. And in the meantime, I'd moved back here and I got a new sponsor named Lila. And by this time, you know, I was really ready to look at a lot of things that I just hadn't been able to look at. And she was having me, you know, when you get a new sponsor, they make you start over at step one, you know. And of course she did. And so I thought, well, step four is going to be just like that, because I've already done it twice. And man, that thing was intense. It was like pages long. It was like, I didn't even realize, because we met together, and I'm like, well, I don't have any resentments. And she's like, you're full of it. You've been talking to me. I know you have resentments. What about this? What about that? I'm like, oh, yeah. So we started doing that, and I started looking at those things that I really did not want to look at. And then I started making that amends list after we went through my fifth step, and I started doing the amends list. And I showed her my amends list, and some of the people, she's like, well, why do you have to make amends to them just because you thought bad things? What are you going to do, go up and say, you know, I thought you were a real bitch, you know, but I didn't do anything to you, but I just think that about you. You know, that's like where you're, you know, like you make amends except when to do so would injure them or others. You know, that would just hurt them. That's not going to help them. And so, you know, she's pointed out to me different areas where I really needed to make amends, and I went about doing that. And there was this one woman I worked with, and this was like kind of a big one, and I really kind of minimized with my sponsor, you know, the harm I had done to her. But I had been her boss, and I rode her like white on rice. You know, I was just like on her all the time. And she just really, you know, I made her life miserable. And I knew how I behaved towards her was really bad. And Lila's like, well, you know, it looks like, you know, she needed the reprimand for that. And I'm like, yeah, but, you know, I know I came down on her really hard. And so, you know, since it was just this nagging thing that I knew I needed to make amends to her. And so, but every time I would actually come into contact with her, it was like in these huge public places, like tons of people all around. So I'm like, well, I'm not going to do it now. But then I'd try to get with her privately, and I could never get with her privately. And so finally one day I'm in Sunny Farms. You know how it is in Sunny Farms. There's just like tons of people. You can hardly walk. And there she is. I'm like, well, I got to do it. And so I made my amends to her, and I asked, is there anything you want to add? She started bawling and telling me off, and, you know, I really harmed that woman. Yeah. And, I mean, I actually was not humiliated, because I just felt so badly that I had really done that much harm, and I had not even noticed, known that I did that. I had minimized, and that really made me realize how much I minimize what I'm doing to other people, because I hadn't thought I'd done that much harm to her. But when I asked her if she wanted to add anything, and she did, and she told me what it was like, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, I just hate being a supervisor, but I kept getting in these positions to kind of like, because that was kind of one of the ways that I have to make amends, is to change how I treat people that, you know. And so, you know, I just like struggle with this and talk to my sponsor and, you know, and one of the things in the big book, because I just think, oh, I did it again, and I'd have to make amends. But I love this part in the big book. It's on page 86, and it talks about, because, you know, making amends is really changing our behavior. It's setting things right. It's not just going and saying you're sorry. So it talks about on page 87, it is not probable that we are going to be inspired at all times. We might pay for this presumption in all sorts of absurd actions and ideas. Nevertheless, we find that our thinking will, as time passes, be more and more on the plane of inspiration. We come to rely upon it. And that's what, you know, the women that have sponsored me have always told me, you know, just time takes time. You know, it does get better. And just, it's like, you know, if you've always done something a certain way, it takes time to, you know, to change that. My sponsor in Alaska, her name was Pam, and she would say, you know, to this day, there are these ruts in the ground from the wagon trains that came over. And you can go on the Oregon Trail, and there's these huge ruts. They didn't even have to have a map. They could just follow the ruts. Their wagon trains would just go in the ruts. And that's how our minds are. We get these thoughts, and we get these ruts. And, you know, we try to get out of this way of thinking, and we fall back into that rut. And it just takes a while to get out of that. And don't be hard on yourself if you fall back in there. You just got to gradually, you know, get back out. And so that brings me to the next thing that has really, really, I think, saved me and helped me to stay out of that rut. And I still, you know, I'm not perfect. I still totally get back into thinking, you know, negative thoughts. But, you know, my sponsor, she really talks about using a mantra and meditation and prayer. And so I remember when she first told me to use a mantra, what she told me to do is like, get a mantra, and mine happens to be "Thy will be done." And when you're doing something mindless, like driving to work or doing the dishes, think of your mantra. And so I started trying it, and it was like, man, this is hard, because when I'm doing that, I can't plan what I'm going to do and what I'm going to say to these people when they give me a hard time, how I'm going to react. And she's like, right. And so I started using that. And when I'm struggling and thinking negative thoughts, I realize I need to start using my mantra more, and I need to step up my meditation, which is basically, you know, there's all different ways to do meditation. But the way that I do it is I actually focus on the third step prayer, seventh step prayer, and 11th step prayer, because a couple of men in recovery, I would always hear them say they start their day with 3, 7, and 11. And they seemed so peaceful, and I thought, I want that. And so, it's Rich is one of them. And so that's what I meditate on in the mornings. And then once in a while, my sponsor will suggest other prayers and things. But, you know, I went from just, you know, wanting to die and not being able to put the drink down to now I wake up in the morning and I am excited to be awake. I mean, like, I want to live, I want to be alive, and I don't want to drink. And I remember, you know, the first time that I realized that, I had about 3 years. I mean, it took me a long time. And I was driving down the road crying because, you know, something terrible had happened. I was not. But no matter how terrible this was, all of a sudden I realized, I don't want to drink and I don't want to die. What a miracle. What a miracle that we do not want to drink and we don't want to die, because we are alcoholics, and that's what we want to do, is we want to drink. And so I just want to end with a couple of milestones have kind of passed. One of them for me that was really huge was the 10 years, because I had relapsed at 10 years. So when I got past that 10 years, it was like, you know, and it made me realize, though, you know, just because I have 10 years or 11 years or whatever, I'm not past doing the things. I'm still in danger. My first sponsor, Phoenix, she used to always say, you know, every day you're sober, you're one day closer to having a drink. And on all my milestones, she would call and say, you need to go to more meetings and, you know, read the book more. And then another thing happened is, so I've had two marriages actually end during my sobriety, but I didn't have to drink over them, and I still didn't want to die. And then the other thing is, like, a year ago, I bought a house, and that was kind of scary because, you know, the first time I relapsed, it was when we bought a house, and I had a drink. I only had two drinks, really. But, you know, I bought a house, and what was really cool is a lot of you in this room helped me move into that house, and you've been there in my house, and I haven't drank in this house, and so that is like a huge milestone for me. And so what I really see that I'm growing now is I'm like starting to realize that, well, I've tried to kind of go towards this and it has really helped me, but I think more and more that what I try to do, and I don't always do it, is instead of seeing what I can get out of everything, is think about what can I give? What can I contribute? whether it's at my job, the meeting I go to, but I still get, you know, pissy about meetings. Like, we had a group conscience last night, and I was just like, oh, I need a meeting now. My relationships with my parents, you know, instead of me always trying to think, what am I going to get from them? I really, you know, am trying to, it's like so much more of a joy to think, you know, what can I do for them? Because they have done a lot for me. They have really blazed the way for my recovery. And, you know, what can I add to my relationship with my children and my boyfriend and my friends? And when I think of things, that is not the normal way that I think, just so you know. I'm reminded to think that way because I call my sponsor, and I have a number of women who I think of as my sponsor, and I get together with great people, and I get involved in things. Like right now I'm on the activities committee, and I cook at the breakfast meeting, and I do things like that, and I get together with women and we go through the steps. And those things keep my mind from going back into that rut, because you know, I do go back into that rut. Like I am working a second job right now, and I miss just 1 week of meetings, and I can't believe how squirrely I get. Just 1 week, you know, just total negative. Everyone's just, you know, I'm mad at everyone. And I realize now, I see it's not them, it's me. You know, it's not the other people, it's me. And so I do just want you all to know, you know, if it can happen for me, it can really happen for you. And, you know, I hope that even if you have time, that my message, you know, gave you a little bit of hope. I do want to read the promises, if I can find them. I thought I had a marker in here. I'm like, where did it go? Okay. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Thanks, everyone, for being a part of my show.